Audio hosting for Comics Are Great is provided by Kablam, KABLAM.com, the one-stop printing solution for independent comics publishers. This time on the show, who is the story being told to? Every town has quiet hiding cartoonists, and leveling up comes at a cost. All this and more on Comics Are Great. I think comics are great, and that's why we do this show every week at the Ann Arbor District Library, streamed live at 12:30 p.m. At comicsgreat.tv from, like I said, the Ann Arbor District Library at the corner of 5th and William. This is a show where we just talk about making comics, publishing your own comics, working with publishers, distributing your comics, thinking about storytelling stuff, like why are some panels big, why are some panels small, all sorts of nerdy process, and then also, you know, on-the-ground, businessy type of stuff, too. And my name is Drusy Droz, cartoonist and teaching artist, and with me today are some super exciting people that I'm so glad to finally talk to face-to-face. Up on the screen, on the Skypes, well, actually, yeah, we got your names under you right now. There we go. Joamette Gill of, let's see, okay, joamette.tumblr.com. That's where you can find all your Homestuck fan art, yes? It's not Tumblr if there's not Homestuck fan art on it.
It's true.
And, but then also, you know, the Olympia Cartoonist Collective and Project Chance and Blackbirds, your webcomic, a lot of stuff that we're going to talk about in at length here in a second. But thank you. Good to finally talk to you face to face, Joamette.
Yeah, likewise.
And to her left on the screen is a guy who, you know, he doesn't need any introduction, but we'll do it anyway. Brian Denham. Denham or Denham? I'm sorry, I should have asked you before we started recording.
Denim, like the jeans.
Okay, so BrianDenham.com, Twitter.com/BrianDenham. Let's go through some of the books you've worked on. Nova, Thunderbolts, Avengers, the Angel books from Buffy the Vampire Slayer. And you also run a site called IllCraft.com, what do we do there?
I do tutorials about Adobe Illustrator, because I think it's just awesome.
There's a story behind that, like why you illustrate in Adobe Illustrator, which we were talking pre-show about how, like, yeah, it's called Illustrator, you think you would, but it's something where a lot of cartoonists, a lot of artists in general, really have a hard time wrapping their brain around this program. It's a vector program, first of all, but there's a reason that you chose to start working in it, right?
Yeah, I had hand surgery in year 2000, and it was really hard to draw on paper anymore. And my brother, who worked at Microsoft at the time, he was like, you need to go digital. So he bought me an iMac and a Wacom tablet and sent me a program Illustrator, you know. And so I started working on that, and I got back into being able to draw because it wasn't hurting my hand to actually hold the stylus, you know.
And why was it different? I mean, what's different about using the stylus on the Wacom versus using pen on paper?
Well, like if you use a pencil, you know, to get differing line widths, you have to kind of press harder. And holding the pencil like that was just killing my hand. So, like, even now I can use a stylus for, you know, 16 hours straight without any kind of hand cramping. Whereas before with a pencil, you know, a couple hours in and your fingers start cramping up and you get the claw, you know.
The occupational hazard of our career, yes. I once pulled a 16-hour day, and yeah, it's like right. I'm in my headphones. This muscle right here, whatever that's called, I should know that because as a cartoonist, I should know it. But this guy here, and then also right here, yeah, just you're like that the rest of the day. Do you still have that setup where you got the double monitor with the Cintiq? Because I saw a picture of that, and I was just, oh god, that was such a great idea.
No, about a year ago, I'd sold the Cintiq to a guy that was. Animator and trying out for Disney and, you know, as an artist and stuff. And I went back to paper for a while, and then I went and, you know, my hand is fine like that. And then I went to my old Wacom stylus, you know, and now I'm building up to getting another Cintiq because it works a lot better. You know, I don't know what I was thinking selling it, you know, but I was like, I'm going to go paper.
Yeah, I saw some of the latest pieces that you posted on your blog, and the Captain America piece, and you're working on paper again. Looks amazing. But what I thought was a great idea is what you, when you had that setup, is that you had a monitor turned on its side so you could see the page in its full, you know, full size, like looking at the whole thing while you're zoomed in on the Cintiq so you can work close. I mean, what a great idea. I never even thought of that, because one of the things that I have trouble with digital illustration is getting lost in that zoom, you know, going further and further in until finally it's like, I don't even know what I'm working on anymore, or I don't know if I'm putting too much detail on something that doesn't matter anymore, you know? So having like a double monitor setup like that is like terrific, terrific idea. So to be able to see it.
I remember doing the Iron Man book, and I was drawing Iron Man's car. He's driving around in a fancy race car, and I made all the wheel really cool looking and stuff. And then I zoomed out, and it's like it wasn't even going to be half an inch. That was several hours getting all the spokes right or whatever.
And even though printing technology has improved a lot in the last 20 years, still, that's just going to turn to mud when you actually get it in print, right?
Black dot.
So cool. Okay, well, I want to turn to Joe, Matt. I'm gonna slowly introduce you guys to the listeners, and then we're going to get to like the big topic today. Joe and Matt, you got your fingers in a lot of pies. I want to talk a little bit about the Olympia Cartoonists Collective for a second, because that's an interesting thing that you do. So what's that all about? That's at olycartoonist.wordpress.com.
That's right. That all got started about a couple months away from the beginning of 2011, so I want to say November. I was sort of getting into the full swing of deciding, okay, cartoons are what I'm going to focus 110% of my attention on from now on. But I found that I have difficulty concentrating and staying motivated, not because I don't love comics, but because of other issues that I have going on. So I realized that the last time I was really, really pumped and didn't really need to give making comics a second thought at all was when I was in art school. And what really helped me about that was being constantly surrounded by other creatives, people that had a million and one projects going on. Just the spirit of art in the air is something that I need to focus. So I reached out to our local comic shop, Danger Room Comics in downtown Olympia, and told them that I wanted to start a collective, just a group of local cartoonists who would get together maybe once a week and just work together and talk about comics and keep each other excited. And they put out a Twitter call, and they get followed by lots of local cartoonists. And much to my surprise, most of the people that are in the collective now, we have about 10 people who regularly show up to meetings, and over 20, I think we have like 25 people that keep up with our events and our galleries and participate in them. Most of those people didn't know the others existed until we got together as the Olympia Comics Collective, and we've been doing that every single week since January 2nd. In fact, I have a meeting later today at 5.
Oh, wow. So, what? I mean, do you have a sense of what the roster consists of? Like, how many people are involved nowadays?
How many people or what sorts of cartoonists?
What sorts of cartoonists and like what? Just give me a picture of like what kind of community you've managed to assemble through this thing, because that's what's interesting to me. Is it all a bunch of people who are pals in the same college and they just get together and just continue on with college, or are you reaching out to new people through this thing?
We are not a well-oiled machine when it comes to reaching out. Our membership keeps growing slowly but surely, simply because we keep putting ourselves out there. Uh-huh. More and more cartoonists keep hearing about us and then showing up at meetings saying, "Hi, I'm whomever. I heard you guys are a comics collective." And that's pretty much how it's gone so far. We have a pretty good mix of cartoonists. I do digital art and web comics, and I like to tell stories in a more, a longer graphic novel-y issue per issue breakdown, whereas we also have a lot of people that do the strip format, who are really inspired by Watterson and Schultz, and that's what they aspire towards, getting into the newspapers. And some of them are comedy strips. Some of them do political cartoons that are really, really amazing. And some people write fantasy. Some people write autobio. We just got pretty much everything going on.
And nobody comes to the thing saying, like, oh, you're an autobio jerk, or, oh, you're a manga jerk, or none of that stuff goes on? No, West Side Story throwdowns?
No, we do have a little bit of just kind of looking at each other with our heads tilted going, you sound really excited about that. I'm not excited about it, but it's cool that you're excited.
How nice for you. but this is neat that you're building a community in your area. Like, just instead of just going on Twitter and saying, so alone, you did something about it. I'm curious, Brian, what's your network like in your area? I mean, how do you get through? Because it's a solitary gig, right? We spend a lot of time in the studio alone.
Yeah, I've been lucky in my career. I've worked at several different studios. I started at Extreme Studios in 94, and I worked at Top Cow Studios in 2000. And I'm at Antarctic Press right now in San Antonio. I got like 16 guys here, all doing different, men and women, doing different aspects of comics, And it's really cool to have that many people. I know every day it's just like some random 10-minute conversation leads into a story or a comic or a t-shirt design or something like that. And it's just like, wow, that just was a joke 2 minutes ago, and now it's like, put it on a shirt,
Good point. Really good point is that it does boost your creativity, because something that would just be an offhanded kind of casual chuckle moment for you alone in the studio can turn into a conversation. And like, if you're standing next to a whiteboard or if you got a notebook, suddenly it can explode into something else, right? Yeah, I've had comics.
A year ago, I got here at the studio and, I had an idea. I talked to the boss about it. And I mean, this was just within a few minutes. And now it's like our biggest selling title. And, we got more issues of it coming out. And it's just like, that was just a random conversation, it's just, it really neat how it works out.
Well, that's super cool. And I'm sure it's the same thing with the Olympia Collective as well, right, Joe, Matt?
Yes. In fact, we have an ongoing project that came up about 2 months into us getting together. And that is a series of Olympia cartoonist anthologies. We've made 2 so far, and that is essentially just a collection of anthologies we're going to continue doing every few months, with like a really huge one once a year. And those pretty much just consist of somebody throwing out a theme that everyone thinks, oh, whoa, that's so cool or funny. And we get as many members of the collective or people who aren't able to participate every week but are still down with the collective spirits of comics making in Olympia, and we slap it all together into as great as an anthology or group of or collection of comics as we can. And we are working on making a profit on those. And all of the profits that come from it stay with the collective. They don't assist any one of us individually. Like, it's not like we can reach into the collective fund and buy a pizza. We're working up to the point where we can supplement our own income in acquiring a studio in downtown Olympia.
Nice.
So we want to have an open studio that welcomes any one of the sequential persuasion to just come in and jam together whenever.
Anybody who's made that lifestyle choice.
You have decided to be poor. Come, welcome.
Somebody's saying in the chat, Neela's in here saying, man, I wish I could hang out with other artists regularly in person like that. And okay. Joe, Matt, you're still, you're a pup, 20-something years old, yet you're putting this thing together. What advice would you give to somebody wherever they are? I mean, do they have to emigrate? Do they have to go to San Antonio? Do they have to go to Olympia? Do they have to go to Ann Arbor in order to meet other cartoonists? Or can they start something like this in their town? And if so, how do they do it?
Well, I'd like to think that every single city everywhere is full of quiet, hiding cartoonists just waiting to be discovered. Hopefully we don't live in a world where that's not true. So with that basic assumption, talk to people. figure out who it is you should be talking to. I think the very first people you might want to talk to are owners of your local comic book shops. And if you go to one of them and they're not friendly, find a different comic book shop and see if they're friendly and more willing to help. Or just hang out there, talk to the people that come in, ask them if they make their own comics. This, I pretty much got this together by being really loud and saying, hey, hey you, do you make comics? Do you? Come to this meeting. Do it.
So a sense of aggression might help?
Yeah, I had a baseball bat with me too.
Well, some people are saying in the chat that, you know, there's no comic store in their area. I don't know if there's anything else we could point them at. I mean, we just had Sharon Iverson on. Anybody who's new to the show, we had Sharon Iverson on a couple episodes ago where we did a full hour and a half talking about starting up comics events at libraries. So that might be worth a listen. I don't know, Brian, if you have any thoughts on this at all, on how to get a community going.
You know, comic book stores are great. I know when I was coming up, I worked at a comic book store, and Scott Kurtz was a customer there, and another guy, his name was J.C. Vaughn, and, you know, he's in charge of, you know, Gemstone now or something. Like, it's amazing how you can start out with people that, you know, you all come up at the same time. It's just great, you know, and I think, like, with DeviantArt, too, you can... I know they used to have that thing where you can check a local area, but I'm sure there's, you know, they may have gotten rid of that, but I'm sure there's some kind of process you can do on DeviantArt to find local people or,
yeah, you
know. And really with Twitter too and all that stuff now and Facebook, it's like if you know somebody, they know somebody. It's just like you just can connect that way, you know.
Yeah, I make sure to, as much as possible, whenever I'm tagging on Twitter an event that's happening in Ann Arbor that's comics related, I use the comics hashtag and then the Ann Arbor hashtag. So anybody who's searching for either of those things will hopefully find it, right? Because with any luck, the people who are in that area are looking for that.
Yeah. I don't know, like I had a random conversation at Target one day with this elderly lady putting all the comic book nerd t-shirts back on the shelf, you know, they're all disarrayed and whatever, and her granddaughter wanted to be a comic artist. And I was like, that's just to meet somebody that knows somebody else. You know, and it's just like, send her to the studio. We'll teach her whatever she needs to know and stuff. So.
That's true. Yeah, it is. It's a long process. And it's also about looking for those opportunities, being aware of when the opportunities pop up so you can point people at the right place, right? Yeah. But then also, like you were saying, Joe, Matt, it was like having a shared vision, too, because I was in a comics collective when I was your age, actually, and the president of the club, we had a budget. We were university funded. We actually had a budget for this club, and, you know, we were all deciding what to do with this money. Well, do we want to put it into the printing of an anthology? Let's just use it for a pizza party where we dress up as superheroes. And I was like, oh, wow, really? That's what we're going to do with this comics club, huh? I thought we were all going to make something here. So, yeah, if you don't have a shared vision, if you don't have, like, you need a strong leader, somebody with a baseball bat, or, like, Brian has, like, all the guns behind him, for those who aren't watching the video. Brian's calling in from his arsenal, from his bunker. you know, like a strong presence to sort of drive the vision of the thing too. It probably would help a little bit, I would imagine. But I don't want to belabor that too much. It's an interesting thing that you're doing, Joe, Matt. And, you know, hats off to you for trying to, you know, pulling up the bootstraps and saying, like, I don't know any cartoonists in the area. Well, I'll figure out where they are. Because this is something a lot of people moan about. So, okay, let's talk about, let's see, you also do a webcomic called Blackbirds, and that's at blackinbird.com. And I was looking through.
No,
the,
actually.
No?
Black Ink Bird is my portfolio / news blog deal. Blackbirds.smackjeeves.com is where the comic is hosted.
That's right. Okay, I put the wrong Earl in my notes here. But I was digging through the archives, and man, oh man, the art has changed a lot in just like the last couple of years, like a year and a half or so. Like, you look at some of those early pages versus now. So there's like a perfect example of just stick with it, right?
Yeah, I'd say so. I'd like to think so.
The latest pages look a lot different than the early pages. So, but it's cool that you leave the old pages up, too, because this is another thing that I think a lot of cartoonists like to do is go back and revise their old material, and I'm glad that you didn't. I'm glad that you're just letting it grow and stand on its own, right? Because, Brian, I mean, I can ask you, because you come from the same sort of time period of comics that I do, growing up on comics in that time period. This is something when you were reading monthly, you just got used to, right? It's like Eric Larson's stuff did not look the same when he was doing Amazing Spider-Man as when he did Savage Dragon. It evolved. It grew, right?
Yeah, and I think that's one thing, like, you know, at least being in print is a little bit more, well, you know, like with the internet, you know, you put something up a year later, you've learned so much more. You know, there's the inclination just to take it down so nobody ever sees it again, you know.
Yeah.
You know, comments are forever. It's out there, you know, and it's like, oh, my, you know, like all my early work, oh, my God, I hated it so bad. And I even destroyed all the original art at one point because it's like I cannot move forward until I know nobody will ever see this again, at least, you know, on the paper form.
And, wow. Wow. So, like, you had to do that as, like, a ceremony to feel like...
Yeah. Yeah, and I made sure every sheet was at least four rips in it before it went to the trash can, you know.
Just, oh, my gosh. That is intense, man.
Yeah, it's funny now seeing, like, people bring it to me at the comic conventions and stuff. It's like, oh, gosh, you know, I got to look through this. I totally blocked it from my mind. I don't want any, I don't want to know what the past looked like. You
know? Always look forward.
Yeah.
Have you ever had an experience where you look back and you're like, okay, 99% of this is junk, but there's this one moment where the young Brian Denham, he knew what he was doing here. That was good, at least, right? Do you ever catch that?
Yeah, and I know, like, when I worked at Extreme Studios in 94, you know, when I started my career, you know, when Jomet was born, you know, people saw stuff in my work that I did not at the time. And later, I was able to look back on it and go, oh, I can see what they were looking at, or, you know, see how I actually got hired in the first place or something, you know, because early on, you're like, I'm great. Why am I not getting hired? And then you get hired and you're like, I'm terrible. What am I doing? And later there's that piece where you're like, I can understand what people saw and what got developed, you know.
You're painting a very rosy picture of this career path. No, you know what's funny? This is something I try to tell my students all the time. Is I do a lot of comics workshops, and I start a lot of my workshops with a page of art that I did when I was 11, and then a page of art that I did a few years ago. And I don't tell them who drew them. I just ask, which do you like better? And there's always 30% of the room that likes the stuff I did when I was 11 better. And I ask them why. They're like, well, it's clearer. It's easier to read. It's not as mess. It's not as busy. And, you know, there's too many words on the new on the other one. And then I tell them, you know, well, I did that when I was 11. And it's funny to me that some of you would like that stuff better, which points to the fact that, however we feel about the work, letting it stand allows somebody who's going to like it to find it. Right? Because, like you said, you know, they're seeing something in it that you obviously aren't seeing. And so as long as somebody's enjoying it, I'm not advocating laziness. Like, hey, look, you don't need to learn how to draw. Because we got to pursue our own sense of satisfaction and excellence and whatnot. But on the other hand, I think there's, like, I've noticed since the advent of webcomics, there is this sort of syndrome sometimes of people who want to go back and endlessly revise to make it all consistent. And we don't need to, do we?
No, and especially if you do go back. I know, like, I did this book for Marvel a couple years ago, Iron Man Hypervelocity, and they were telling us as it started that, you know, we're going to put it off for a year for the Civil War event. So I was able to draw the first issue, the second issue, third, and by the time I got to the third, is like I'd progressed so much that the art didn't look the same in the first issue. So I had to go back to the first issue and draw that one over and draw the second over. Third one, you know, a little bit touch-ups. By the time I got to the sixth issue, you know, it didn't look the same. So I had to go back and balance it out, you know.
Wow.
Took a year and a half to complete all six and have a steady style because I was changing so fast. And sometimes you do that, you draw a page, and you're like, this is great, and 10 minutes later, you can see all the flaws, you know. And like, you've leveled up, you've learned so much by doing that, you're a completely different artist as it's done, and you know, it's hard to stop yourself to change. Otherwise, you're going to be working on the same page forever, and, you know, you'll never progress, you know.
Right. Leveling up comes with a cost, right? You know, it's like... Okay, so moving on, I want to talk a little bit about the Project Chance that you guys are working on together, and I want to give some background on where it came from. Joe Amet, you are in the Womanthology anthology, and we don't need to go into too much detail. We'll link to it in the show notes. It was this big, made a lot of news, a lot of headlines, because it was a super successful Kickstarter campaign. Just to give us, like, a one-sentence, two-sentence description of what Womanthology is, for those who haven't heard of it yet.
Womanthology is an all-female comics anthology organized by Renee DeLeese. And its purpose was simply to give as many undiscovered or previously unpublished women creators as possible an opportunity to experience the professional process from conceiving of a project, looking for collaborators, to submitting their work to an editor, learning how to work with one, and then finally the payoff of seeing their work in print published by a major publisher, IDW.
And so you had a story in there with Katie Shanahan, and, and she's at ktshy.blogspot.com. So you contributed a piece to this, but then also there was this really, so the way Kickstarter works, for those who haven't heard of it, there you can pledge, like a PBS kind of drive, you pledge a contribution, and but there can be different pledge tiers where you pledge $25, you get this kind of like thank you gift, and you pledge $100, you get this kind of thank you gift. And then you scroll all the way down, there's this massive $1,500 pledge level, only one gift for that, and it was to have Brian Denham, draw a 22-page script, penciled inked, colored, lettered, of anything you want. And the neat thing that you did, Brian, that I think is so cool, is that you specifically said, if you are a company who could afford to hire me anyway, don't pledge for that. This is specifically to go to somebody who could use a huge boost to their career. You wanted this to be an opportunity to provide professional-grade services to somebody who's trying to break into the industry, as it were, right?
Yeah, they're even setting up the original price for the Kickstarter fund was, you know, it's like, well, it should be this much, which was very expensive, you know, and
oh yeah,
and me and Renee were talking on the you know, on the Gmails there. It's like, this is not you know, she agreed to, we don't want it for somebody that can afford to hire somebody, because that's not what it's about. You know, it's about somebody that really, really wants it, you know, independent of how much they have, you know, or how much they can afford, you know, or whatever. So it's like, we did lower the price enough that, you know, it may be hard for a young writer artist to try to get it, or it may take a toll, you know, like being very expensive at that time, but you know,
but to put it,
if you're a rich debutante, just hold off, you know.
Yes, so then the next thing you know, you're doing a comic about the Junior League for the new annual fundraiser.
This little teacup, it's like, that thing's $20,000. I've never seen one of those in the photo.
No, but, you know, we should say, for those who are listening who aren't familiar with what a cartoonist's rates are, $1,500 is exceedingly cheap for a 22-page comic. That is not what a cartoonist gets for a 22-page comic book, penciled, inked, colored, and lettered. So that was a huge, huge discount, but it still was a high enough threshold that you'd have to really want it in order to, you know, get that, right?
Yeah.
But I just thought that was super cool of you to offer something like this. I think this is something that, you know, more veteran cartoonists should consider as a way of, like, paying it forward. Right, is like, okay, well, I can give like a Twitter shout out to somebody who needs a boost, like, hey, go look at this thing, how much more are you putting your money where your mouth is if you're offering to do a substantial amount of work that you're doing for this thing?
Yeah, so, I know, starting my career, I you know, I had to self-publish a comic, and it because I wasn't getting a result showing my work to editors, and it was very expensive to self-publish it at the time. But doing that, I learned every step of the comic book process. Doing that allowed me to meet Rob Liefeld, who was like, wow, you are very serious about comics, you know, do you want to work for me? And it's like, well, I could continue to publish stuff on my own and go broke, which I already had, you know. It's like, I had $20 when I met him to my name, you know, and it's like, it took so much to afford that printing bill. But it's like, yeah, you know, I had people that helped me along the way to publish it. I had Rob help me by hiring me, and all those guys in the studio helped me at the time, and I was like, you've got to give back, you know, and the next generation's, you know, coming up quick, and you got to help them out, you know.
Yeah, yeah, so super, super cool of you to do that. And then, so you guys, so Joe Met, you were the lucky winner of the prize, and you decided to do something really interesting with it, and then this is being documented at projectchancecomic.tumblr.com. It's called Project Chance. Did the name come out of providing a chance for you? I mean, is that... or is there something else to it?
The name of the Tumblr is sort of, it's kind of a shout out to Renee DeLees and just the amazing amount of work and effort she put into making Womanthology happen for us. On one of the Kickstarter updates that she issued towards the end of the Kickstarter campaign was an idea that she had floating around for what she wanted to do with any extra funds that were left over from the Womanthology printing costs. And that idea was for an imprint, or to suggest an imprint that could be taken up by one of the major publishers. And her suggested name for it was Project Chance.
Okay.
The idea was that it would be an imprint for people who had been previously unpublished or weren't, or were still considered amateurs, so that they could have the first issue of their suggested series published, and have all the profits of any sales that they garnered go back into funding more printing for more Project Chance imprint comics. And if the sales were high enough, then the larger publisher would commit to signing that creator on for a longer run of their series, at which point they would be officially published, and I imagine start making some revenue from the series that they've created. This is still an idea that she has. It's a possibility. And at the time, I didn't have an official title for the script that I was working on, so I decided to name the Tumblr Project Chance, because it was born out of the huge chance that Renee was looking to give all of us. Right as of now, the comic script does have a title. It's called Exile. Right. But I didn't want to rename the Tumblr to throw everybody off.
Okay, let's talk about Exile for a second here. So the story is, kid meets some extra-dimensional creatures by the name of, is it Orin and Stout?
Yes.
Orin and Stout, who are exiled to Earth. They ask for the kid's help to use an ancient weapon called the Exile to transport them back to their world, and in exchange, they will grant this person one wish. Alexi Rivera, 10th grader, the main character?
Yes.
And then there's an interesting line in your description that I want to talk about for a second here. This Alexi Rivera was assigned the gender of male at birth. What? What are you talking about? Assigned the gender of male. What kind of fantasy sci-fi story is this? That when you, what are we, people coming out of a printing press and like, well, you're going to be a male, you're going to be a female. What are you talking about here?
That's the most realistic part of this story, actually. Alexi Rivera. I know this is an all-ages show, but...
No. We can talk about this kind of stuff. We just can't use the grown-up words is all. So.
Yeah, I was going to say. Because it's hard to talk about these things without talking about the things in your pants. And she... If you were to strip her down, she would look just like a naked Brian or a naked Jersey with all the same parts.
God willing, however, no, that she wouldn't look like a naked Jersey, but continue.
Much younger.
Or svelte.
However, I refer to her as she because that is the proper way to refer to a trans person who considers themselves a woman. On the inside, I guess. The sort of simplistic way of explaining it is that Alexi is a boy in her pants and a girl in her head.
Okay. So we're talking about a fantasy story. I mean, it's obviously if there's, you know, extra dimensional ghosts to say there's a weapon to get us back to our world. That's not happened to me, so I'm thinking this is a fantasy. That deals with trans or gender identity issues. Yes?
Yes.
Does that sound fair to say?
That's correct.
Now, this is where I want to spend, you know, a good 10 minutes or so really digging at this because, and I hope you guys don't mind that I'm going to try to play a little bit devil's advocate on this to try to dig at the topic. This isn't my position. It's just I'm anticipating, okay, what would people out there who, when they say, oh, it's a gender issue superhero fantasy story, they're going to say, why superheroes? Isn't this under the purview of autobio memoir comics? Aren't the people getting published by Fantagraphics and, I don't know, HarperCollins? Don't they got that issue covered? You don't need to do that with a fantasy story, right? What would be your answer to that?
Well, the reason I decided to cover that issue within the sort of superhero context, well, there were a number of reasons. I guess the number one reason for choosing the superhero context is that that is the big thing in comics. When you say comics to someone, a layman on the street, they will think, oh, you're talking about superheroes. In fact, that's the number one response I get whenever I bring up comics to anybody who doesn't make them. And I wanted to create a superhero. I wanted to create one of those iconic figures of the comics medium that would speak to an underrepresented part of the population. I wanted to create a hero, or rather, I wanted to create a protagonist that didn't just have a bunch of problems and was telling you about them, but a protagonist that not only has all these problems, but is portrayed as the ideal person, someone who has so much more strength and so much more power than the average human, someone who's capable of incredible feats while still having this issue and being this type of person.
But, and here's where I'm playing devil's advocate again, okay? I'm playing a role here. This is what we used to call on the old Art and Story Show, Evil Jersey, because I'm just trying to penetrate a topic with devil's advocate sort of thinking. Why not just do it through a metaphor? Because superheroes are metaphors, right? Why not just have an alien born in a human's body or switched at birth? Or like Zaven from Runaways, who you mentioned on the blog, right? Was a Skrull, and Skrulls are shape changers, so they can be confused about their gender. And then it doesn't have to be quite so straightforward. Why are you throwing this in our face, right? Because Peter Parker, he communicates to all genders, all races, doesn't he? You don't need to throw that out there, do you?
I do. And here's why. The reason I would never want to represent anyone from any minority through a metaphor or through a body swap is because I feel like that completely sidesteps issues of representation in comics, and it completely sidesteps I think something beyond representation, representation being who you actually see in front of you, what type of person you're actually getting told a story about, and that is the issue of who these stories are being told to, the intended audience. And I'm sure we all know the term the male gaze. That's when something is presented from the lens of the male experience or made to cater to what is considered a male's interests or what males want to see. But I would also say that there is such a thing as the heterosexual cisgendered gaze. When you have a story about, for example, a kid who ends up body swapping with someone of the opposite gender as themselves, and then they have to go through a few days or months or however long living life as that gender and getting to learn a lesson about what it is to be different, then that story doesn't seem to be talking to someone who is trans, someone who knows exactly what that's like. It's preaching to the choir. So the only conclusion I can reach is that that story is aimed towards people not experiencing that. That story is being told to people who need to know, people who don't know from experience. And I think there's sort of an overabundance of that because the vast majority of comics are created by people who don't belong to underrepresented minorities. So it seems only natural that they would, at least most of the time, try to tell the story in such a way that they would get it, in such a way that they can relate to it, because every story comes within yourself, obviously. But yeah, it's harder to find a character that is just literally that type of person, literally going through that as opposed to figuratively. And the reason I wanted to create someone like that isn't because I thought that would educate somebody better. I'm not really interested in educating anybody. If somebody learns from this, that's great. But what I'm more interested in is having someone who already knows what the deal is pick it up, open it, and say, whoa, that person's like me. My story matters because someone's telling it.
You know, this could be borderline insulting to somebody who's actually been a marginalized person. Mm-hmm. But as a guy who was never marginalized beyond the typical stereotypical, you're a dork, you like Garbage Pail Kids, and you like My Little Pony, we're going to punch you around a little bit. Beyond that marginalization that I experienced as a young person, I do remember reading the Blackhawks comic books from DC Comics back when I was a little kid, and I found out that they were Polish, and I'm very, very Polish with like a tiny touch of Russian. And I was like, and there was a guy in the team whose last name was Drozdowski. And I was like, his name's like my name. These guys are like my people, but they're fighting guys. They're punching Nazis in the face and whatever. So I have a brush with that experience and that kind of identification with something. And I can report that even with my minor brush with that, it felt pretty good. So I can totally imagine that would be the case. But also, like, somebody in the chat is saying, and I think this is an interesting point, saying talking about this topic in memoir style would be more like throwing it in people's faces than putting it in a fantasy story. Now, okay, Brian, you have spent a long time doing lots and lots of different kinds of fantasy stories with superpowers and different things like that. I mean, you have been hip deep in these kinds of metaphors and ideas that have been explored like that, right? I don't know if you could speak to this at all, that like by putting a transgender character up front, you're sort of, but by making it a fantasy story, does that not in fact sort of like take some of the pressure off of the whole issue of the transgender thing? Because you're sort of just promoting them as in the context of this fabulous world. Oh yeah, they're a superhero and they happen to be this, right? Isn't that what you're trying to go for? Oh, I lost your audio. I don't know what happened to your audio, Brian. I can't hear you all of a sudden. Joe, Matt, can you talk?
Yes.
Oh. So suddenly, oh, we lost Brian. I asked him a really hard, interesting question. And then somebody's mentioning Garbage Pail Kids. Wait, whoa, Garbage Pail Kids. I'm talking about when I was a little kid. I collected Garbage Pail Kids. And not even a little kid. I'm going to say I was in junior high, and I remember getting some grief from some of my fellows. But okay, while we wait for Brian to come back, let's see if I can call him real quick. I'll hang up on him and then I will add him to the call. Oh, Brian, there we go.
Perfect timing.
Yeah, no, technology's still not perfect. So, okay, while we wait for Brian to come back, if we can get him back, Joe and Matt, I wonder if you can speak to this at all, like what I just threw out there.
Him disappearing threw me off. Can you repeat the question?
by somebody in the chat threw out the notion that, oh, maybe he's coming back now. But this is great radio, everybody.
So suspenseful.
We're crossing our fingers that he's coming back. Okay, well, we'll just try to be professional and push on while we're dealing with this technical issue. So somebody threw in the chat that like exploring transgender issues through a memoir would be actually more like throwing it in somebody's face than say nesting it as an incidental feature of a larger fantasy narrative. Perhaps I'm paraphrasing what the person said in the chat, but I'm just wondering if you can speak to that. Like, is that sort of what happens? By putting it in a superhero or a fantasy universe, does that kind of take the pressure off of blasting the issues at the world and sort of like, let's tell a good story about a person who happens to be transgendered?
Mm. Well, I guess first of all, I am totally in favor of blasting issues in everybody's face. I feel that people who are confronted with an issue and their first thought is, oh my God, why are you being so loud about it, are the exact people that need to examine, I guess, their way of thinking and their way of perceiving other people. Because when Peter Parker is griping about how Mary Jane is mad at him because he had to be Superman, or sorry, he had to be Spider-Man.
Oh, man. There goes your comics cred.
Career done. But yeah, when Peter Parker is griping about his life issues, nobody says, oh, Peter Parker, you're throwing being a working man in my face. Just shut up. I don't appreciate your class consciousness. I don't appreciate being talked down to by this writer. Nobody thinks that. And it's because people accept that that's a real problem and people can relate to it. And there are certain things that aren't dealt with as widely, and therefore less people find that they're able to relate to it. But we're all human, and if we try a little harder, we can all relate to pretty much anything we all go through. That said, part the decision to make it fantastical was a more, I guess, an aesthetic choice, because I only write fantasy. That's my genre.
Yeah. It's a taste thing, right? It's like where it's where you're comfortable in storytelling, right?
And I like writing fantasy because I only ever tell stories about underrepresented people, because I don't really feel the urge to write a story about someone that isn't. And I find that just everything about fantasy lends itself so well to allegory. You can turn any story into that perfect metaphor for the issue that you're talking about, and it doesn't matter what's going on in that world. It all comes from your imagination. You can make all of it up, pull it all out of your head, and make it what it needs to be to communicate the message without the bounds of reality.
You know, another funny thing that I think of whenever these kind of issues come up and people get really kind of, you know, their knickers in a twist about it is we're talking about fantasy stories. We're talking about stories about heroes and good and evil and the grays in between. And usually a hero, at least in Western society, a lot of times, I'm not saying every time, but a lot of times, they tend to be alone and special. They tend to be marginalized in their way. They're speaking to everybody's sense of isolation, the profound isolation that we all experience, right, in just being a human being. And if you're picking a different lens to look at that sort of idea through, then so be it. But at the same time, you know, it's a sexy headline to say transgender superhero is shaking things up. I mean, that would be good for you, actually, because it would give you good press to get people paying attention to what you're doing, right? Although I'm sure that's not why you're playing that card. You're just playing the card because it's an important issue, right?
Yes, it is. When I first pledged for the Kickstarter incentive to work with Brian, I didn't have an idea in mind at all. Like, I didn't go to it thinking, oh, man, I have this perfect script that I'm working on, or, oh, there's this thing I've always wanted to make. I can have this guy draw it for me. I just thought, I'll write something for it, because I'm going to be writing comics anyway. It's what I do. And when I got it, I decided that I guess I wanted to... Like, Brian doing it for me was giving back, and I wanted to also give back using it by making a story that could speak to, I guess, a section of comics readers or a section of potential comics readers who just haven't found that particular story that they're looking for, haven't found their experience represented in the medium. Because I've actually heard from a number of people who have told me, oh, wow, if this becomes a thing, I might start reading comics.
Mm-hmm.
Like, they, to this point, they refuse to read comics because there's nobody like them in comics. And I think that's a really powerful thing. So all I knew from the get-go was that I wanted to choose someone like that to write a story about. I always make a character first and then decide what's going to happen to them.
Yeah. Yep. There you go. There you go. I think that's a nice way to put it. And a lot of it boils down to just doing what feels natural to you. We got Brian back.
Yeah.
and Brian wore his hat to celebrate the return. Brian, can we hear you now? Can you give us some sound? Say something? Oh, I don't know if you can you talk, Brian? Oh, no. We can't hear you. We can't hear you, Brian.
Oh.
But at least he could be here for the close of the show, because now we're coming up on the end. We've got about 10 minutes left, and Sharon Iverson of the Ann Arbor District Library is here. And, gosh, Sharon, good to have you back.
Thanks.
So, yeah, you were on, what, like 2-3 episodes ago? We did a little talk about libraries. And did you hear the story from Ryan Estrada about how we punked him?
No.
Oh, you didn't hear this? This is great.
And I talked to him for quite a while.
Oh, this is great. He posted this on Google Plus. This is why you got to get on Google Plus.
I know.
So he was listening to the show with you and me talking about comics and libraries and doing programming.
Yep.
And he went to his Gmail, his GChat, to send me a message saying how much he was enjoying that episode. And just as he went to the GChat, so he wasn't looking at the screen, all of a sudden we started talking about him and you went, oh, Ryan Estrada. And he froze because he thought, how can they see me right now?
So, oh, that's hilarious.
Yeah, so we scared him. So I think we should just randomly say cartoonist names that we know. Like,
absolutely.
Oh, Janie Ho, you know?
Yeah.
The next thing we know, she'll be listening. Well, if you're listening, Janie, this will be a way we can test them.
Exactly.
But yes, and scare people. So, okay. So, Joe Matt, I don't know if you have any book recommendations to bring to this. If you have some, you're welcome to. But Sharon and I are going to talk about a couple book recommendations real quick, and then we'll wrap up, okay?
Okay.
And while we wait for Brian to come back, we can look at Brian's guns in the meantime. So what do you got for us, Sharon?
Well, I have, mostly today for kids, I have a series that I just picked up one of, Knights of the Lunch Table, and it's by Frank Camusso, and it's kind of spun loosely on King Arthur, with the protagonist being Artie King, a middle school age kid, and his two buddies. And in this particular episode called The Dragon Players, they enter a contest to create an dragon robot that will defeat the evil horde, basically the bullies of the school.
Hey, we got Brian back.
Oh, great.
Brian, can you hear us? Oh, I don't think he can hear us.
That's too bad.
We can hear you,
Hello?
Though.
Hello?
Hello?
I can hear you.
Oh, you can. Great. Okay. We're just getting...
I can hear you, too.
Great. Awesome.
Yay.
So we're going to go through a couple quick book recommendations, and then we're going to wrap it up and give you guys a chance for some final thoughts and everything. So continue, Sharon. I'm sorry.
Okay. Another one that it's been out for about a year is Calamity Jack by Dean and... Gosh, I should know her name. Shannon Hale. She's a writer of teen books, and this is spun off of Jack and the Beanstalk, and set kind of in a steampunk setting, where Jack has just helped Rapunzel and has returned to the city to discover that his mother is being held by the giant blunderbuss, and he's got to find a way to, of course, rescue her and deal with it. But it's just kind of a total page turner. You know, can't stop until you find out how it's resolved. And then the last thing I have,
one of my favorite books.
Yes, and it's because of Jersey that I got in touch with creator of Aqualad, Ramona Fraiden, and I'm just holding up one of the books about Aquaman. Ramona's been around for a while, and she has obviously made her name known in both the DC and Marvel circuit, but she also was a cartoonist for 15 years for Brenda Starr, has created a kid's book, and it's called The Dinosaur That Got Tired of Being Extinct, and this is actually a children's book, but she brings the humor and delight in, and as I understand, she really was not the writer for any of the work, most of the work that she had
DC,
ever done.
Right, she was the
but
artist.
Here she kind of uncorks kind of a Seussian rhyming style with this dinosaur who comes back to life in a museum and is searching for the most perfect place for him to fit in and have his buddies.
So you ordered this from her?
I did.
Oh, good for you.
I did. So this was really fun. I mean, I remember reading Brenda Starr when I was a kid, and, you know, you don't think about what influences you, but, you know, here was a female role model that, you know, and I just mentioned it to Matt outside, and he gave me this blank stare. I said, you've never heard of Brenda Starr, right? But I said, she probably influenced me in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it was kind of fun to kind of come full circle and find out who one of the people that was very much involved with her.
And her Aquaman stuff was amazing looking.
Yes.
And she draws the greatest monsters ever.
Yes.
And like I told the story, I think, on a past episode, I met her at Detroit Fan Fair, and sweetest lady in the whole world, just like June Cleaver from Leave It to Beaver, but she likes to draw monsters. And I wanted to beg her to be my mom so badly. Like, why couldn't you be my mom? And we could talk about monsters all day while you make me cookies. Oh, that'd be the best.
Yeah, monster cookies.
Yeah. But yes, this book is great. The dinosaur that got tired of being extinct. Yeah, I got it when I was at the show, and I had to get Dave Roman a copy because I tweeted about it. And he's like, I need it. It's really good. So I don't know how we can get that. I mean, because I think you had to email her directly to get it.
Right,
I'll have to find out where she can put that online for people to purchase. I'll get in touch with her.
Yeah.
Anyway, okay, so is there anything on the calendar that you want to mention?
Yes,
okay.
Sunday we have Joe Fu, creator of Desmond Comics, Desmond the Wolverine, who's a part of a video role-playing game. And Joe will talk to us about what makes a good character. And he kind of will compare classic heroes to his own Desmond and other characters he's created.
And this is at the Ann Arbor Comics Artist Forum, first Sunday of every month, and that's from 1 to 3 p.m. at the downtown
multipurpose room. Right.
See? So we got a community here too, Joe and Matt. No, I'd love to see that communities like that pop up in every city, actually. It's not a competition. Everybody should, like Joe
Matt. Or is it?
Oh.
I'll see you on the playground. No, you know, it's like Joe Matt said earlier, every town has quiet hiding cartoonists in bushes, under rocks, and in trash cans. like the Mutant Ninja Turtles, we're all just hiding, waiting to be found. Okay, so that'll be in the show notes as well. But yeah, AADL.org, just go to the events listings and you'll find it there. So guys, any last thoughts on everything we talked about today? Anything you want to like throw a plug out to? Any appearances that you're making? Anything like that? Brian? Oh, we lost the sound again.
No, I'm just kidding. I'll be at Wizard World Austin next week in Austin, Texas. And then I have one plug I would like to plug is the Anarchy Press series, Diary of a Zombie Kid.
Who worked on that one?
Fred Perry, who's been drawing Gold Digger for 20 years.
Yeah.
And David Hutchison, who's also one of the long-term Anarchy Press guys. And then I'll be drawing issue 2, which comes out next month.
Ah, Diary of a Zombie Kid from Antarctic Press.
Antarctic Press.
Those are good guys. I haven't talked to them in a long time. I'm trying to think who was my editor on PPV.
Herb Millett.
No, it wasn't Herb Millett. I worked on an issue of Ninja High School with him way long time ago. Oh my gosh, I'm blanking on his name, and he's going to kill me twice. I'm going to have to put it in the show notes now, because he doesn't...
So many people cycle through here, but...
Yeah, maybe he's not even there anymore. But anyway, Fred Perry, awesome artist. So much dynamism, so much energy in his stuff, and a lot of comedy. So, I don't know how the man does it.
No, I try to... He's in the studio right next to me, and I try to... pace him some days, and he's just like a monster. It's like 16, 24, 36 hours. I'm just like, oh my God. But he's like productive, you know?
Doug DeLynn. Doug DeLynn was the editor's name. I'm sorry. I don't mean to step on you. It's just it occurred to me now.
He's still here. He just opened the door a little bit ago while we were talking. I'm like, what are you doing?
So, yes, he was a very supportive guy. He was a great guy to work with. But anyway, so yes, the Diary of a Zombie Kid will be in the show notes from Antarctic Press. So, thank you so much, Brian, for not only just taking the time to be here and talk with us, but also for what you did for Joe Matt's project, like what you offered on the Kickstarter campaign. It's super cool. And I think you're setting an example for the rest of us cartoonists to put up or shut up and pay it forward a little bit. You know?
Yeah, exactly. I'm very excited to be working on it.
Very cool. So, Joe Matt, any last-minute thoughts, closing words on this, everything we talked about?
I guess, first of all, while I have... Brian here on Skype, I want to say thank you with my eyes and with my voice, because I've only done it with an email before.
Thank you.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
Yeah.
I'd like to add one to the reading list. I forget the author's name, even though I love her, because I always forget author's names, but the book is called Wandering Sun, It's a manga, and it's being put out by Fantagraphics. It is about two transgender fifth graders who end up discovering each other's secret and going through, you know, the walk of life, growing up, going through middle school and high school as they discover themselves and figure out how to just be true to themselves in the face of the ostracization that comes with being transgender.
People are saying in the chat, thank you so much for the Exile Project. So there you go. People in the chat are excited about it too. So super cool.
You're very welcome. And we will continue to update all of you on what's going on projectchancecomic.tumblr.com.
And then for those, we did a tease at the top with Brian talking about Illustrator tutorials. Anybody who is interested in learning about drawing in Adobe Illustrator, you can go to illcraft.com for information on that. And I think a lot of people are going to be heading over there because that is, it's a super interesting subject, because drawing in a vector program would be, actually in freelance, that's a hot topic right now. Everybody wants you to draw in vector because they want to repurpose it in as many ways as possible, which kind of sucks in freelance, because I used to do billboard illustration and then, like, you know, smaller illustrations to go with campaigns, and I get to charge three times, you know, billboard, small thing, medium sized thing. Now it's like one drawing goes all three. But on the other hand, it makes you more marketable as a freelance illustrator as well. So, And Kim Holm, Denunga Hair Holm on Twitter, is saying in the chat stream, drawing an illustrator is evil and unnatural. Brian will prove you wrong. And anybody who wants to do the opposite of Kim, and you should if you want to be a good person in this world, you should go to illcraft.com and check out some of those tutorials. So thank you guys once again for being here.
Thank you.
Projectchancecomic.tumblr.com and illcraft.com are the two places to go today. So thank you, Sharon.
Sure.
Of AADL.org. Mm-hmm. So the show is recorded every Wednesday at 12:30 p.m. Eastern Time at the Ann Arbor District Library at comicsaregreat.tv. And we'll have links to all this stuff in the show notes. Thanks to Eric and Twitter links and where to follow these folks. And until next time, I've been Jersey Drozd of comicsaregreat.com and Jersey on the Twitters. Okay, bye.